Birth, Chapter 25. In 1950, President Harry S. Truman approved the construction of a deep underground facility that could be used as a relocation site for the Pentagon in times of national emergency. 500,000 cubic yards of super-hard greenstone granite rock was secretly blasted out and hauled away in 10 months. 5 separate 3-story buildings were built deep inside the Raven Rock Mountain, located on the Pennsylvania-Maryland border. The buildings look like ordinary office buildings set inside a hollowed-out cavern deep inside the mountain. The underground complex has roads and parking areas big enough to accommodate trucks and buses. Site R is completely self-sufficient with 2 power plants to generate electricity, multiple underground water reservoirs, and a sophisticated ventilation system. The facility can operate for at least 30 days in a buttoned-up position and can accommodate 3,000 persons in an emergency. In addition to the basic life support requirements of power, water, and air, the underground metropolis also contains a medical and dental clinic, fire department, post office, dining facility, snack bar, dormitories, chapel, barber shop, fitness center, bowling alley, and even a Starbucks. Marine One is a modified Sikorsky UH-60 Sea King designed to carry 4 passengers. It also has numerous defensive features and communications upgrades to sustain what the best think tank surmised might be methods a terrorist might use to shoot it down. It can land in water and has deployable airbags to keep it stable in fairly choppy seas. Riker walked briskly out of the White House with John and Enoch 1 step behind. He waved to the tourists and onlookers who happened to be in the area. He found himself practicing his wave in the mirror because he didn't want to look like Forrest Gump waving to Lieutenant Dan as he jumped off a shrimp boat. This was an unceremonial trip, so there were no cameramen trying to catch him tripping or picking his nose. He snapped his salute to the Marines standing at attention at the bottom of the stairs. Within a minute or two, they were airborne and heading for Camp David. "We will arrive before the team," began John, explaining the mission. "Hadid left an hour ago in a smaller craft to do forward checks. He will have the vehicles ready when we arrive. You will take off again and remain airborne until we arrive at the entrance. We will draw any assault, because they won't expect you to be alone." "Who would try to stop us?" asked Riker. "We're not sure, but it's best not to take chances," said John. "You better put this on, Mr. President," said Enoch, handing him a vest. "Your coat?" he asked as he held out his other hand. Riker removed his coat and put on the vest and velcroed the fasteners. Enoch stood to slide a hanger through the jacket and hung it up in the small closet. He removed a blue jacket with the letters FBI in yellow across the back. "Put this on," he said. "FBI, huh? Clever," said Riker as he put his arms into the jacket. "Resources," said Enoch. "A moment of indecision could save your life." "I have a question," said Riker, looking at Enoch. "It's been on my mind ever since that first meeting." "I will answer if I am capable, Mr. President." "How many of you are there? I mean, you say there is this ancient order, and they are scattered throughout the inner circles of the world's leaders. How do you all know what to do and when?" "We do not serve 2 masters, if that is what you mean. We would not be allowed near the leaders if we did not protect them with our lives and prove our loyalty to a certain extent," explained Enoch. "I think he's asking about this mission," asked John. "We do not have much time, Mr. President, so let me see if I can help." "Of course, I wasn't implying that." "No, it's quite all right, Mr. President. If I may," said John, holding out his hand with the palm up as if to give something invisible to him. "Go ahead. I just want to know," trailed off Riker. "The Dark Prince has mighty men of old here on the Earth called Watchers. We are not sure how many there are, but we are fairly sure that the one called Semyaza is somewhere in this country and has infiltrated your military," began John. "How can that be?" It's easier than you think, Mr. President. Men with this bloodline are lustful and full of greed. They are taught that their true inheritance was robbed from them, and that by using the dark secret combinations these ancient beings know, they can gain back some of that wealth. Dark promises of great power and honor are delivered to them in this life, so their allegiance is easy to proffer in every age, added Enoch. Yes, then comes the betrayal, said John. It is a process of rules laid down before the worlds were created. It must be this way for the Dark Prince to claim victory. Victory? I talked about that very thing with the Joint Chiefs this morning. I was angry with them for conducting endless battles and never winning a war. No victory. Exactly, Mr. President, said John. The plan is to addict the soul to violence and oppression, and preclude the mind to ideas like freedom and liberty. Once the soul has chosen to follow the dark path, he is prevented from seeing the light ever again, until it is too late. Too late for what? Well, call it repentance, the redemption of the soul, the recognition of wrongdoing and a mighty change of heart, said Enoch. Listen, guys, this is really sounding a little like a Sunday school lesson. Well, then let's call it resonance. If a soul resonates with the light, it will gravitate toward the light. If a soul resonates with darkness, it will have an allergic reaction to the light and shrink into the shadows. Infinite degrees of shadows, said John. So I guess you're saying the whole world is doomed because there's not much light out there that I can see. Well, that is precisely why we are here on this mission, Mr. President, because that is not true, said Enoch. Yes, began John, all over the world there are places where the light shines brightly. There are many more where the light has just ignited, and people are just now awakening. We have to get all of them to look and think in one direction, on one frequency, so to speak. You mean like a second coming or something, stated Riker. It doesn't work like that. Rules, remember? This planet is getting ready to separate into its two original parts, like we do when we die. The difference is that we're talking about billions of souls that are alive and are free to choose which world is theirs, said John with tears nearly coming out of his eyes. Enoch came to his rescue as John wiped his eyes. The Dark Prince wants to keep all those souls here on the temporal world. He believes that they are his inheritance, robbed from him in the garden. His soldier is here, deep in a mountain, commanding forces inside our military, and he means to keep these souls from knowing there is a choice. Our mission is to provide that choice to them today, he said as he stood up in the helicopter. That is why we're going to Site R, the communications center, said Riker as he processed what they were telling him. He was a believer, but there was more than this. All his life, he had shown the ability to know when someone was telling the truth or not. Few people always told the truth. His wife did. He knew in his heart that these agents were telling him the truth. They explained to him the message and the work that billions of souls around the world needed to do. They did not have much time. The moon would be new in a little more than 24 hours. It was then that the Earth phases would separate, and billions of souls would migrate to another place in the universe, while billions more would remain here with Semyaza and his captives. Well, not exactly captives, he reasoned. They would choose the wealth and trappings of mortality over the true inheritance that was promised in the garden. Then he had this wave of doubt come over him. It was like he suddenly remembered that he was here, aboard Marine One, heading for Camp David, a respite for presidents. He was the president. Oh, Jesus, he said out loud. What is it, Mr. President? Asked John. Why me? How can I, you are here for the same reason we are here, said Enoch. Our order learned about a prophecy that a leader will come from outside the conclave of evil. He will be chosen by the people in a remarkable, almost impossible manner, and he will be the one to say the message to the world. That is you, Robert Riker. But I don't feel worthy to do this. I haven't done great things with my life. Feeling you are not worthy is one of the qualifications as well. And you are about to do greater things than we have ever done, said John. We're 10 minutes from the motor pool, came the message over the intercom. You'll do fine, Mr. President. We will be with you, said John. The helicopter was at treetop level now, traveling at more than 150 miles an hour. No radar could detect them at this altitude, and anything shoulder-fired would have only a few milliseconds to aim and fire with the dense trees surrounding Camp David. The UH-60 was heavy, but it was in top-running condition, and the Marine pilot was the best in the HMX-1 fleet, with more than 8,000 hours in the air. The craft banked hard to the left and swung the rear rotor around to slow down to nearly zero. The helicopter settled onto a parking lot next to a motor pool garage with 20 garage doors. John flipped the door open and dropped the air stairs. We will call for you when we are ready. The pilot knows what to do, said Enoch. Keep your seatbelt on. It's going to be quite a ride. The co-pilot emerged from the cockpit and grabbed the air stairs and pulled them in. He latched the door, turned and saluted the president, and then returned to his seat. Within seconds, the Sikorsky leaped off the parking lot and banked hard for the trees. It stayed low, and the tail rose up high, while the main rotor chopped hard into the air like a leopard leaping for its prey. He looked out the windows, but he could only see trees. They were actually flying close to the ground, in clearings, through the trees. They passed over a lake, and then a hay meadow. And then they dropped down onto a river and flew its gentle curves through the forest. Within a few minutes, they were deep into the wilderness surrounding the camp. Suddenly, they pulled up and rose to the top of a mountain that was covered in dense trees. There were no roads. Not even a fire road could be seen. The helicopter circled and climbed higher and higher until the summit passed under them. Then, like a mighty bird of prey spreading its wings, it came to a soft landing on a flat, stony area barely large enough for two helicopters. He could see out of the windows and just through the trees, but it was clear that this was a safe place that no one could see from any place except space. "This is where we wait, Mr. President," said the pilot over the intercom.